Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deadlocked talks over debt reduction between the White House and the President, where it appears that John Boehner, feeling the heat from his Tea Party caucus, is backing out of a deal he made to raise taxes, while it appears Obama has adopted the language of the Republicans in tying the economy to the debt. Richard Parker, an economist at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, joins us. Then we will go to Juba, the capital of South Sudan, a brand new country as of Saturday, and talk with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for South Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. She will fill us in on the festivities and assess the grave challenges ahead for this new country born out of years of civil war with the North. Then finally, we'll talk about the congressional race in the 36th District, nearby in the South Bay, Marina, Mar Vista, and Venice area, where a Tea Party Republican is running against Janice Hahn for the seat that Jane Harman vacated. Former two-term mayor of Manhattan Beach, Mitch Ward, joins us ahead of Tuesday's vote to get an update on a tight race in a predominantly Democratic district where the wealthy Tea Party candidate is pulling out all the stops, hoping for an upset that could resonate across the nation. I'm joined by Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was the co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myths of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Delighted to be with you, Ian, and in light of the story that's going to follow mine, I should mention that I was born and raised in Hermosa Beach, Jane Harman's old district. So,
well, it's a pretty bizarre turn of events that the seat's even threatened.
Shocking, absolutely shocking to me. So I'm not terrified yet, but I'm
no. Well, I think the purpose of my doing the interview is hopefully to stimulate people to get out to vote, you know, because
If I weren't re-registered in Cambridge, where my vote is less useful, I'd re-register instantly in Hermosa again. So,
well, let's talk about. And I also wanted to talk to you about, since you've just come back from Athens, Greece, where you've been working with Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece on the onerous debt packages that the Eurozone has imposed on Greece, so that it doesn't default. But let's talk about the big story here, and that is these negotiations between the White House and John Boehner. And it appears that over the 4th of July weekend, a deal was made where Boehner said that they would, the tax cuts on the wealthy, would the Republicans would allow them to expire. And apparently also President Obama put Medicare cuts on the table as well. And now it appears that Boehner has backed out of that deal, and the White House wants a big deal. The Republicans want a little deal. Is that what you understand?
Well, it's the outlines of what I understand. I guess there are several comments because several things are moving here simultaneously. The fact that these deficits have not closed is a function of the failure of the U.S. economy to recover from the collapse of the Great Recession of 2008-2009, and that, I should note, is the same thing that's driving the predicament in Greece. In other words, both the United States and Europe are not recovering quickly from the financial market meltdown created by Wall Street's flimflammery over the past two decades. And in each, it's producing a crisis that has become a fiscal crisis for the state as a consequence of financial market failure. In the United States, it is the perception that the Obama stimulus that he used on top of the TARP spending by President Bush have not been sufficiently efficient to generate jobs at a cost equal to what's being spent on the stimulus. I disagree with that, but we can talk about that. Similarly, the question of Greece is one of what is it worth to Europe to save Greece if it's a question only of Greece or it's a question of Europe's future as well. And that debate is the one that is the version of this taxes versus revenue versus expenditure cuts going on in the U.S.
But surely, Richard Parker, the fundamental difference here is that Greece has a real crisis, where the United States has a phony crisis, in the sense that Republicans are using extortion and the fear of shutting down the good credit and faith of the United States in order to get what they want in these negotiations. They are using leverage that is frankly insane.
I think that's right, although let me just say about the Greeks, I think that theirs is now a phony crisis in the following sense. They have done everything imaginable to solve their problem within the confines of the Greek economy itself. And if the Greek economy were not part of the Eurozone, in fact, what they have done today would get them well on the way to recovery. Because they're tied to the Eurozone, nothing that they do alone can solve their problem. And so, in a sense, they're being held hostage by the politics of Northern Europe and the reluctance of conservatives in Northern Europe to come to the aid of a fellow European country. And in that sense, I think there is a parallel. I think that, I'd argue for that. Now, to come back to the United States, I mean, I think that the problem here is a problem that we sometimes forget is not a new problem. That is, that the ability to gridlock between the parties is actually quite old. If you think back to the 1950s, when it was on issues of national security and McCarthyism, the parties were quite capable of gridlocking around a whole number of issues. Similarly, in the 1950s and 1960s, until the election of 1964, when in the wake of Kennedy's death, a vast majority of Democrats from outside the South were swept into office, there was gridlock for all intents and purposes on civil rights. Then in the 1980s, you had gridlock around budgetary issues that led to the kind of proposals that would later be characterized as lockbox proposals, the I'm blanking on the name of the bill, but the idea was that there would be that when Congress failed to agree on necessary cuts in the budget, that an automatic cut machine would take over and administer the cuts. Essentially, the Congress walking away from its constitutional responsibilities alongside the White House. And then in the 1990s, of course, you had the Republicans under Newt Gingrich willing to shut the government down not once but twice. Now, you know, I don't think that they're actually willing on the Boehner side, which is, I don't want to describe as the moderate wing of the party, but the less ultra-conservative wing of the party, that they really want to shut down the government or even dare shut down the government. I think that they're terrified of what their ultra-white right wing is pressing them to do. But I think that we're going to have to play showdown and chicken all over again this summer around debt limit extension to sort this out again. Now, did I oppose President Obama getting into these negotiations and accepting the frame of the negotiations as they were established by the Republicans? Yeah, I think that was a bad political tactic, but it's also characteristic of what Obama seems to like to do, which is to move to the center and then open negotiations from there, no matter where his opposite number stands. And, you know, I don't know who taught him negotiation at Harvard Law School, but that's not what my colleagues teach at the Kennedy School about how to do negotiations. That said, if Boehner is backing out of this big deal, and in fact you get so much ruckus raised about doing an even smaller deal by the right, and I'm not sure that that won't happen, Obama may come out of this better than we thought, and that may be ultimately what Obama's counting on, which is that the insane wing of the institutionalized wing or institutionalizable wing of the Republican Party is going to box Boehner in so badly that Obama will ultimately emerge from this not having had to give up much of anything, but with the Republicans looking disorganized and penurious and only for the rich once again. But we have yet to see whether that gets played out that way.
Well, the fact of the matter is that it appears that Obama has adopted the language of the Republicans in tying the economy to the debt, and that Boehner's fallback position is the one that Vice President Biden offered. So they've already given away the store. Apparently they're negotiating a bigger deal to give away more of the store in terms of Medicaid, but that was tied to tax cuts for the wealthy or letting them expire. Now, there's bad blood between Cantor and Boehner. I think Cantor is quite happy to see Boehner twist in the wind here. But my, I still get back to Richard Parker to this puzzlement over why accept this insane leverage in the first place. If somebody is pours gasoline over themselves and threatening to light a match, you get the fire hose. You don't then say, oh, wait a minute, let me pour gasoline over myself and then we can negotiate.
I like the metaphor here. Well, again, I mean, you know, we've seen this about Obama, and people on the left and liberal side of the spectrum have been complaining about this since the very first negotiations, such as they were, about the Obama package, the Obama stimulus package in the spring of 2009. If you'll recall, you know, Charlie Grassley and others said, well, we're not going to support a stimulus package this big unless there are big tax breaks put into this, tax cuts put into this as part of the package. Obama then immediately rolled over and said, okay, made something like 40% of the package tax cuts rather than stimulus spending. And, of course, not one of the Republicans, including Grassley, voted for it.
And so we know that the stimulus has run out.
They're going to do this. Right, exactly.
And that's the reason why the economy stalled, and that's the reason why unemployment jumped to 9.2%, and the Labor Department's report showing virtually no job growth has made everybody incredibly depressed, but it shouldn't be a surprise. This is the nature of it. Now, do you believe, Richard, what Chuck Schumer said the other day, that it looks like the Republicans are sabotaging the recovery for political gain?
I think that they're willing to sabotage the recovery. I don't think you can speak of them as unitary, the Republicans. I think that they're divided, but I think that the net effect is that they're willing to do so because they want to tell a story about this as an ongoing failure to recover because of quote-unquote democratic methods being used to solve the problem. They view this as an Antietam or a Gettysburg kind of struggle, that they're going to have to win on this. This is for them part of the civil war that they've conducted now around these budgetary issues for the last 30 years. As I noted earlier, I mean, they've been in the past around national security issues or around race issues, but now they're around budgetary issues. And, you know, they have done for their core clientele, the top 10% or the top 1% of Americans, they have done extremely well for that clientele over the last 30 years. I don't need to rehash for you the numbers about income and wealth distribution. And so why should they back down now? I mean, ultimately, you know, the idea that the economy's recovery is wrecked in terms of employment gains is not of enormous concern as long as corporate profits are healthy. And we've had now 2 years since the bottom of the recovery in which corporate profits have been not just healthy, but spectacular, in fact, record spectacular, and we've seen no significant rundown in terms of unemployment. So I'm not sure that when we talk about wrecking the economy, we're talking about the same thing, because I don't think we should all be thinking that we're all concerned about the same economy. The economy has many different faces, and for the investing classes and the working classes, they happen to be two different economies.
Yeah, but you just got through Richard Parker saying that, in effect, Obama asked for too little when he was riding in on all of that support that he had back in when he first came into office. The first thing that they tried to do was to stimulate the economy. He accepted tax cuts instead of real spending, and lots of economists, including Paul Krugman and others, argued the stimulus wasn't enough and it was going to peter out, and they've been absolutely right. It's petered out at this crucial moment, just as we're beginning the campaigns, it seems. So again, the Republicans have a very effective narrative, even though it's a bogus one. The deficit hoax, if you will, has become the narrative instead of the revenue crisis. And I don't understand why it is that we can't the president can't make these points that really it's all about jobs. If you got people back to work, the deficit would go away. It would be a non-issue. Why have they accepted their rhetoric and boxed themselves into this phony narrative?
You know, again, I mean, I'm an economist. I'm not a political analyst as such who stays still closely in touch with all that goes on inside the Beltway. But what I know about the Beltway are several things. First of all, there is an upper middle class professional community there directly tied to politics as an industry. It is not affected by the larger economic cycles outside of the Beltway. In fact, the Washington housing market has continued to rise for the last 5 years, where every place else housing has collapsed. It's a reflection of the prosperity that goes with a kind of permanent government-business relationship. And in that permanent government-business relationship, the professionals working this year on the government side anticipate that at some point in the future, they're going to work on the business side. And it's the business side, law and corporations, that offer the most lucrative remuneration. And I don't think that in this period that people think that they want to soil the possible nest in which they would land once their government careers are over. So I think that's issue number one, is just the structure of the way the class operates inside of Washington. And it's not even a partisan issue. It's a fully bipartisan issue. The second is that we're now moving into the fundraising drive, the first big fundraising push of the presidential campaign. And we know that Wall Street has frightened Democratic fundraisers, including Schumer, with this bogus narrative that Obama has not done enough for Wall Street. You and I would disagree with that vividly, but to the degree that it locks up checkbooks on Wall Street, the Democrats in the White House are very worried about how to unlock those checkbooks, because their position is they need money first of all. They've got plenty of time to deliver the votes, and most of the left and liberal wing of the Democratic Party is not going to go anyplace. They'll complain, they'll howl, they'll whimper, they'll cry, but they're not going to abandon the Democratic Party in favor of the Republican Party when push comes to shove. So that leads us to number three, which is, how do you position yourself to make clear to donors and to the media that reflect the interests of donors what it is that you will stand for? And if, in fact, you're willing to signal your flexibility on issues of taxation of the well-to-do and an eagerness to cut the cost of government when it involves expenditures on the middle, working, and poor, middle class, working class, and poor, then you're setting yourself up for a rich haul over the next 12 months during this first electoral cycle, which is basically the fundraising electoral cycle. And given that Obama feels that he's likely to face, you know, well-financed Republican opposition, having your money in place in this off year in anticipation of going into 12 is more important than courting voters, all things else being equal. So, I think those are all factors, and I think that we can't walk away from them. We may not like them, but they do seem to me to be the factors that are most relevant here as you watch Obama behave the way he does.
Well, I suppose in a way, Richard Parker, what you're saying is that we're in an era where money is more important than votes, and that the power of money is greater than the power of votes. And the reason that the president isn't pointing out at this very moment, Wall Street is enjoying record profits and record bonuses, and we just learned the pay of the corporate CEOs has gone up astronomically, with I think the head of Viacom getting some huge package of $80-90 million plus. And I think all the polls indicate that the average American does actually think is concerned about the disparity in wealth in this country.
Absolutely. And it's bipartisan concern. I mean, you look at the number of Americans, and it's up on the level of 70-80% of Americans are upset about this. And that's not all Democrats. I mean, that includes a large number of independents and of Republicans. And yet the lesson for politicians coming out of the 2010 election was, Obama's got no coattails, and the Democratic narrative isn't strong enough to keep Democrats in office. And in fact, an aggressive Republican counterattack led to essentially, something that looked like the Somme or, a World War One battlefield circa 1917. I mean, there was a slaughter of the Democratic Party in the congressional elections of 2010, and that memory is far more vivid for elected officials than polls. Polls can move, polls can be made to move, but when you watch 65 of your colleagues vaporize in an election that was unprecedented, basically, in terms of the size of the losses, you take a lesson out of that about, maybe they aren't as strong as they say they are in the polls about caring about this issue. So.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Richard Parker, again, Richard Parker teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's just returned from Athens, Greece, where he's been consulting with Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece on their debt packages imposed by the European Union. But if you look at the simple statistics of in 2008, 140 million Americans voted. In 2010, only 75 million Americans voted. To my mind, the lesson is that the people who voted for Obama in 2008, half of them didn't show up because they weren't inspired, whereas they were before. And I think you have to give George W. Bush credit for inspiring people to vote for Obama. What happened to that energy? Have they lost it? Is there any way to recapture it? Is it because people feel disappointed? They had unrealistic expectations. Whatever the answers are, the reality is, and unless those 140 million come back in 2012, the Republicans are going to win.
Right. Now, just a couple things. One, the rule of thumb is that in off-year elections, meaning non-presidential mm-hmm. elections, you're going to vaporize 30 to 40% of presidential year voters. So just if the cycle had followed normal course, you would have chopped that 140 down to about 90 or something like that. So it isn't the absolute fall from the 2008 to the 2010 number that is so dismaying. It is that the 2010 number was so remarkably strong in terms of absolute number of voters, and then in terms of the composition of voters, the number of voters who are not historically believers in the electoral system. And I think you're absolutely on point about your core idea that, you know, Obama's voters, the voters that were most inspired by Obama, seem to have been the ones on the liberal side to have stayed home. And that, on the other hand, we should mention that in the interim, there was a part of the right that was inspired by the emergence of the Tea Party in a way that probably pushed their numbers up significantly, even as liberal numbers were falling. So there were two processes at work, both connected with the behavior of the Obama administration, to be sure.
Well, what's your prediction then in closing, Richard Parker, about how these negotiations will take place, will pan out, given the apparent peculiar negotiating strategy of the White House, where they come in with too little and end up accepting too little?
My prediction is that the two sides will find their way to a package smaller than the Biden package, which they had previously negotiated. And secondly, that we're going to dance up to the edge of debt default at least once, if not twice, before they get to that reduced package. And that in the aftermath, you're then going to have a media duel about who won and who lost over that. And that that will be overwhelmed by new rolling news about the U.S. economy not recovering, more trouble in Europe. Just anticipate in the next week that the Europeans are going to announce the results of new stress tests on the European banking system, and I promise you that the news is not going to be good, and it's going to frighten markets again, and we're going to start back on another one of these chicken little sky is falling kinds of narratives that are going to dominate the press. So that I think that what we're going to get is less than either side originally anticipated. We're going to do it in a climate of more hysteria, and that whatever the result is, it's going to be overwhelmed by yet more bad news to come, both from outside the U.S. and inside the U.S. as these economies of the West fail to recover because of these mad austerity programs that the right is imposing on both sides of the Atlantic.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Parker.
Ian, good to talk with you as always, and good luck in Manhattan Beach.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He just returned from Greece, where he's been consulting with Prime Minister Papandreou over their problems with their mounting debt. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and go to Juba, the capital of the new country of South Sudan.
Can't get health if you don't have wealth. Can't fix schools if we don't have tools. Can't afford the gas to fill up the tank. Big boys are taking us to the bank. The corporations hate it like a lover's scorn. They want freedom to buy politicians. Of course they would rather keep with tradition.
Californians, keep on your feet.
And that's the new national anthem of South Sudan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who's the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. And Susan, amid all of the celebrations in Southern Sudan on the occasion of its independence, I take it that the challenges ahead for this country are pretty daunting.
They are indeed. And it's been a very exhilarating week and culminating with the jubilation yesterday, kind of a jubilation in Juba, if you'll forgive the pun, but really a wonderful occasion, and I was lucky enough to have a ticket to see the ceremony, so it was very exciting to be there among all the thousands of people celebrating and weeping and just joyously happy. But as you say, there's a real challenge ahead for this new baby country. Although the people here, the officials here say, you know, they've been working as a government for 5 years, so it's not completely new to them. But still, with the history of conflict for so many years, there are many, many problems that need to be addressed.
Well, according to reports that I've seen, Susan Purdon, that at the celebrations that you witnessed, where African heads of states came by in their motorcades, included in the procession was the motorcade with General Bashir from the north, who's indicted by the International Criminal Court and has been persecuting the south, yet he got an enormous cheer from the crowd.
He did get recognition as their head of state. There are lots of mixed emotions for people. They do have a history of having been part of this country. And I think that one could interpret the emotion of the crowd as happy to see him come and acknowledge that they are independent. So there was a lot of conversation in Juba leading up to yesterday, trying to decide if he was coming and if he wasn't coming and whether it was better if he came or not. But I think at the end, the people really appreciated the fact that he is a head of state and he did come forward to say he welcomed South Sudan as an independent country and acknowledged the importance of having a peaceful relationship and moving forward, understanding that they have a common history. So, yeah, there are lots of mixed things going on here at the time.
Well, the fundamental situation in terms of the new country's viability is that the oil largely exploited by the Chinese is in the south, in this new country, but the pipelines to get it to the market are in the north. And there have been skirmishes and battles over Abyei, the region on the border, and quite a bit of bombing, I take it, in the mountains as well. So where does the military situation stand, even though we've had this celebration yesterday? The fighting is barely over, and it's certainly nobody could suggest that there's a real peace.
Absolutely, and there are many issues along the length of the border that remain unresolved. It's one of the biggest concerns following the six-year period of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, where those issues were supposed to have been resolved before the referendum on separation, which was held in January. But in fact, the concerns persist to this day. So Abyei erupted in violence in May this year, and a few weeks ago there was an agreement to cease fire with Ethiopian troops coming in to try to maintain the peace while the two sides continue to negotiate with international mediators to come to an agreement on the border, which continues along beyond Abyei to South Kordofan and Blue Nile. All of those are called the three N's, which remain unresolved as far as border dispute and sovereignty. So, and those areas in particular, Abyei and South Kordofan, and the state that has become part of the new South Sudan Unity State, all are the areas where the oil fields lie. And the decision on sharing the revenue from the oil is another one that's unresolved. During the period of the peace agreement, it was 50-50, the split from the money that was gained from the sale of the oil. Even the oil that was pumped from the south through the pipeline to the north, when the north sold the oil, it was the Khartoum government, it was one country, the half of the revenue from that was destined to support the government of the south. Right now, I haven't heard that there's been an agreement reached, and everyone is waiting to see how that turns out. There are talks about, a 60-40, a 50-50 split. Who knows what the final agreement is going to be. But there's definitely that interdependence between what's now the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan, that the oil fields lie in the south and the pipeline lies in the north.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee, and we're talking to her. She's in Juba, the capital of this brand new country, South Sudan. In many ways, it would seem that one would have to credit former President George W. Bush, who in 2005 put the warring groups together, the Southern Rebels and the government in Khartoum, and came up with this agreement, which is the basis for this, which then had a referendum and now has resulted in a new country. And I take it that the new president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, wears a cowboy hat that George W. Bush gave him?
That's the legend. I don't know if it's the same hat or a replacement, but I have heard that George W. Bush gave him the cowboy hat. He definitely wears a black cowboy hat all the time. He wore it yesterday. And also in the U.S. delegation that attended the ceremonies yesterday, it was led by Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and she was with Colin Powell, who was, of course, a part of the George W. Bush administration at the time that peace was negotiated. So it was kind of an acknowledgement by President Obama of that contribution.
And do you think that it's a justified acknowledgement?
I do think that we have to recognize that the effort to bring resolution was supported a lot along the way during the period of the George W. Bush administration by a number of various groups in the U.S. and internationally who were in support of a way forward that ended the decades of conflict that have affected South Sudan, and a way that allowed for justice and peace and liberty to become the situation for the people who had struggled for so long.
So do you
In
think
fact, justice, peace, and prosperity are the motto of the new South of the Republic of South Sudan?
Well, those are high hopes, I take it, given the baseline from which this country is starting. How, though, do you deal with, or how does one deal with the bitterness in the north, that they've lost half of their... it was the largest country in Africa, and now it's split largely in two, and the south, of course, is not only is where the oil is, it's also much more fertile, and the nomads would come down from the north.
That's true. But there has been a really difficult relationship between the north and the south, and of course the central government, the Khartoum government, and other marginalized portions of Sudan. So Darfur is still in the north, but also has problems, and the east of Sudan also has problems. What I hear from the people here in the south and what we heard from the people up on the stand at the celebration yesterday is that the people of South Sudan feel liberated from an oppressive government structure that predates even the forming of the nation, even during colonial times. Even before colonial times, there was a marginalization of the peripheral parts of Sudan. So that struggle for freedom is very long-standing for the people of the South. At the same time, we saw images on TV from Khartoum of people in Khartoum saying, it's okay, it's, you know, the split has come. There are fundamental differences between the two portions of the country. But we have a long history so that the people on the street are saying positive things about one another. It's, as I say, I keep saying, it's quite complicated and mixed. There are pros and cons on every issue, and positive and negative on every issue. But the people in the South are determined to enjoy the freedom and to maintain peace. And they'll work through the difficulties, whatever they may be.
Well, of course, the South fought a long guerrilla war, and its leader was apparently a very skillful guerrilla fighter who died somewhat mysteriously. I take it that in the North there are little glimmers of the Arab Spring, aren't there? It's not as if everybody in the North supports General Omar Bashir, the indicted war criminal.
There are definitely a variety of factions in the North and an opposition political party and group or other opposition, as well as a number of different rebel groups fighting against that government. So the Sudan, the North, or the remainder of Sudan, still has struggles internally. It's going to be interesting to see what evolves as far as Bashir in power and the future of the government of the North.
So in terms of the United States, given the extent to which the U.S. Helped bring about this situation, it is, I think, obviously a big deal, is it not, for a country to split itself in half, and it's not entirely clear whether the divorce will be amicable. But is there a danger that we will forget this place now and move on?
There has been concern that South Sudan reached the headlines in January with the referendum on independence, and again now with the achievement of independence, and a concern that, you know, it's the 15 minutes of fame that's soon to fade. But the international community has stated clearly an interest in supporting South Sudan to become a viable country and to support its development. One of the factors that people are dealing with here is from the legacy of decades of war. Now we have a new nation that's one of the least developed countries on Earth. And so the international community still has a responsibility to help support the development of systems, the development of economy, the strengthening of the ability for the government to control its borders, to have a secure country. It has to develop a fiduciary system and join the international community of nations. There are so many things that are on the agenda of this new government, and every international government has pledged its support for staying the course, doing what's necessary over a number of years to help keep stability, to help make sure basic services are available to people in the process of the transition to the responsibility of the government of South Sudan to provide all the services necessary to be an independent and independently functioning country. The fact that it's so undeveloped or underdeveloped means that it needs some cushion right now. But the fact that it has oil wealth and a fertile land, a lot of land, a strong population that's looking for opportunity, I think means that this transition will happen, that the external support will reduce over time and the internal strength will continue to grow. were three guarantors of the peace agreement, the U.S. government, the British government, and the Norwegian government. And they were all represented at the ceremony yesterday, and they continue to pledge support for the future of South Sudan.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who's the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. But just on that issue of development and fertile land, my understanding, and I've interviewed a few people about this, is that there's a sort of a land grab going on in Africa now, not just with Chinese investment, but also American and British hedge funds, in the sense that they can buy up fertile land and as a hedge against global warming in countries that whose agriculture is being adversely affected, that this is something that is going to be happening in the future, and that vast quantities of agricultural land are being gobbled up as quickly as possible. Is there any evidence of that happening in southern Sudan?
There is definitely evidence of that happening, and there was a report that describes a number of these very hedge fund land grabs in South Sudan. And again, this government is intelligent. The people in the government are intelligent and understand those things are happening, and they're trying to enact a new constitution and a set of laws that will create an environment where business and entrepreneurship can come and flourish, but also that will protect the country and the revenue streams so that the land grabs don't exploit and extract all of the value, but that there can be an opportunity for business to make money and for that business to provide support for the development of South Sudan. So it's a tricky thing right now because the reach of the government in control of the territories and implementation of the laws that exist is not as strong as it could be. So that's an area that is going to have to be corrected and quickly.
Just on a personal note, obviously it was a joyful day yesterday. Is there any kind of hangover today, or is there a sense of optimism?
It's been interesting to be in town today. You know, from Friday night at midnight, the celebrating started. There were horns honking and people out shouting and cheering. And Saturday was a huge event with the lowering of the Sudan flag and the raising of the South Sudan flag and visits of all the dignitaries. But it's a three-day holiday, so Saturday, Sunday, and Monday are holidays. And town today is very quiet. Families are celebrating. Communities in the rural areas are celebrating. But business as usual isn't happening. People are really reflecting and appreciating the moment, and I think gearing up for the hard work ahead. On a personal note, I feel privileged to have been a witness. It was amazing. As you've pointed out several times, it's a big challenge moving forward. Most of our work is in the provision of basic services, health care for people in rural areas. And we are supported by donor government funds to do that, and we'll continue to do that. And our aim is to hand over that responsibility to the local government, to the county health department, as they come online, as their systems develop, as they get stronger, and then we'll work ourselves out of work, I hope.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Susan Purdon. Again, Susan Purdon is the country director for South Sudan for the International Rescue Committee, and we spoke to her. She is in Juba, the capital of this new country, South Sudan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Oh, arise and shine, raise your flag with the guiding star, and sing a song of freedom with joy. Forevermore, so Lord bless our Sudan, so Lord bless our Sudan. Look out, here come the South Bay surfers. California's getting hot.
we'll find the big one.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Mitch Ward, who was the former mayor of Manhattan Beach, elected in 2006 and then again in 2009. He currently serves on the Manhattan Beach City Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mitch Ward.
Well, thank you very much, and I am the former mayor of the city of Manhattan Beach, and I am very honored to be on your program. It's a very pleasure to be here.
Well, we just had a little bit of Manhattan Beach surf music, and I take it that the candidate, Craig Huey, the Tea Party candidate, is driving around South Bay now in a big convertible, throwing out tennis balls with his name on it. And the reason I think that this is an important story is that this is a safe Democratic seat that was held by Jane Harman, and now there's a chance that the Tea Party could snap it up. And it has, therefore, has really serious national implications. So a lot of people around the country are watching this race. You're there on the ground. This is your district. You're a mayor of one of the important cities in the district. What's your reading on the chances of Craig Huey creating an upset?
Well, yeah, I believe that Janice Hahn is the strongest candidate here in the South Bay. I've worked alongside her, served on boards and commissions with the Southern California Association of Government. I've observed her as she works alongside other elected officials. She works exceptionally well with them. The Republican Party has devolved from the party of no to the party of destruction. And the teabag party that Craig represents is part of that parallel. And he is just out of touch with what the 36th Congressional District is all about. We are a moderate district. If you look at the vote on Proposition 8, which was the vote to ban same-sex marriage in the state, we had the highest no on 8 vote outside of West Hollywood in this district. So we are a moderate district, and the Teabag Party is extreme, too extreme for this district. And we believe that Janice will prevail on Tuesday.
Well, but surely, Mitch Ward, it will depend upon turnout, won't it? I mean, the Tea Party are fired up across the country. They surprised all the pundits in 2010. They've become a very powerful voice in the Republican Party in the House, and I'm not sure that the progressives are particularly motivated. I mean, a lot of the progressives that you talk about in your district voted for Marcy Winograd, who lost, who came in after Janice Hahn, and then Craig Huey came in second, and then Deborah Bowen, the Secretary of State, came in third, and Marcy Winograd came in fourth. And arguably that, you know, Deborah Bowen, Marcy Winograd siphoned a lot of votes that Deborah Bowen would have had. She would have come in second, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation because Craig Huey wouldn't be running. So,
we are where we are. And as everyone knows, I was a strong supporter of Marcy Winograd back in 2006 and also here in the primary, doing her run against Jane Harman. And as we moved on, we both, Marcy and I, have strongly endorsed Janice. And the people who have expressed to me how they admire what Marcy and I have done in that category, they said that they're coming out to vote and they're going to vote for Janice Hahn. So I feel strongly that that the left contingency of our party will come out because there are deep ramifications to women, minorities, people of the LGBT, seniors, all across the spectrum. It is very, very important that we get out and support someone who is not as extreme as Craig Huey is. And so we believe that the left of the party and the moderates and independents of the party will come together and support Janice. And I'm out headed down to the pier here a little bit later, and we're going to try to round up a few more votes here for Janice Hahn here this afternoon. So we're encouraged, and I'm very encouraged that we're going to get good support for Janice this coming Tuesday.
But again, I'm speaking with Mitch Ward, who was he's the former mayor of Manhattan Beach, elected both in 2006 and then again in 2009. He currently serves on the Manhattan Beach City Council. We're talking about this important race in the 36th District, which the vote is on this coming Tuesday. And it could have national implications if the Tea Party candidate wins. He's a self-financed millionaire, I take it. He seems to be a sort of, what, as an overgrown fraternity boy? Would that be an unkind way to describe him?
Well, I don't want to name call in that way.
I'm doing it for you, so go ahead.
I don't know very much about his background. He doesn't live here in the district. And as you look on the city council of Manhattan Beach over the years and the months since Janice got into this race, she has the support of both the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Independent on the Manhattan Beach City Council, and Craig Huey does not. So I don't really know very much about his background, so I couldn't get into the point of trying to label him in any other way other than the extremist views that I've read about in the paper and the debate that I heard the other day. So I will leave the labeling to others.
Well, the reason I say that caution here is that the commercials that he put out, his campaign, these hit attacks against Janice Hahn, received national attention. They were all, Chris Matthews and others were playing them on MSNBC, and CNN were also reporting on it because it was so extraordinary. I mean, it's beyond the pale what he was. He portrayed his opponent, the Democrat, as a kind of go-go dancer and taking money from African-American street gangs. I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, I had no connection to reality.
That approach to politics is the lowest, in my opinion. And the individuals that I've spoken to in regards to that matter agree. And any candidate that associates themselves indirectly or directly, I believe, is complicit with that type of message. We denounce it, and we called upon Craig to denounce that type of messaging, but he refuses, and he's, I think that will attract some of the more extreme individuals of our district. But I don't believe that we have enough of those extremists here to bring him over the top. Again, we're going to put together a great coalition of our left, our moderates, and independents, and conservatives here in the South Bay in the 36th District for Janice. And we will see Tuesday, but we're very confident right now.
Well, pardon me for being the party pooper here, but in these off-term elections and this election, of course,
right,
was because of the of Jane Harman retiring. The turnout is always incredibly low, and again, there is a national interest in this race because this would be a massive Tea Party upset, and it would resonate across the country. And it all comes down to turnout. And this guy's got a lot of money, and he apparently will pull out nothing. There's nothing he won't sink to in his campaign, and we've seen that we know how successful Karl Rove has been in terms of getting people out to vote by taking the low road. And again, I'm just wondering whether the progressives who voted for Marcy Winograd are sufficiently motivated and recognize what's at stake here and how dangerous this Craig Huey is.
Well, I think that if you listen to what I consider the chatter on the internet, on the various blogs and the email chains that I get from the progressives and some of the progressive caucuses, they find very keenly the importance of this race, especially when it comes to a woman's right to choose. We have many, many women that are very, very motivated to make sure that our district stays a district of choice, because The overwhelming majority of us believe in that, and Craig Healy does not. And so we feel very strongly that what I'm seeing coming across to me in emails and stuff I see posted on Facebook and all the other social networking sites, it's looking good, but you're right. We can't be complacent, and we can't sit around. We must call people, and we must say, hey, you've got to get out. If you believed in Marcy Winograd as I did in 2006, 2009, 2010, you cannot drop the ball now. You must get out and vote on Tuesday for Janice Hahn, because it would just be throwing all of that we worked so hard for, Marcy. We would throw it all out the window.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mitch Ward. Again, the former two-time mayor of Manhattan Beach, California. He currently serves on the Manhattan Beach Council. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? We began with Richard Parker, who's just back from Greece, where he's been working with the Greek Prime Minister Papandreou, who's under tremendous pressure from the European Union to service the debt that they've piled up. He was able to talk about there's a real problem in Greece, but there's a phony problem in Washington, where the Republicans are using the threat of a debt ceiling crisis in order to extract concessions from the Democrats and from the White House. And we did discuss why it is that Obama appears to have adopted the language of the Republicans in tying the economy to the debt, and how much he's given away unnecessarily. And it is a true puzzlement, and that seems to be the negotiating strategy from the Obama people all along. In fact, Parker pointed out that when they first came into office and they got the first stimulus, they tried to make a deal with the Republicans, who insisted on a lot of the stimulus being tax cuts, which Obama then agreed to. But then he got no Republican votes, which indicates that he got had. He should have had a stimulus that was all stimulus money, no tax cuts. We wouldn't be in the economic hole that we're in today. Then we talked with Susan Purdon, who was in Juba, the capital of the new country, South Sudan. She gave us a very, very wonderful flavor of the celebrations and also the tremendous challenges ahead. We also talked about the great land grab in Africa that's going on, where Sudan, huge chunks of this new country are being bought up by the Chinese and by American and British hedge funds. So that was an interesting discussion. And then finally, we talked about a race in the 36th district here in California, where the Tea Party candidate could win, and that would be a national upset. And even though it's a local story, it has national implications, because this Tea Party guy is a raging nutcase, and this is a safe Democratic seat. But of course, the left split the vote three ways in the primary, and whether the supporters of the left-wing candidate who didn't make it are going to show up will be a real issue. And of course, I think in many ways that reflects the whole challenge in 2012. The Tea Party will surely show up, but will the left show up? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.